Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit.
I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a book about journeys.
I'm Joseph Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you are looking for a book about journeys, I would recommend Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, A Savage Journey into the Heart of American Dream by Dr. Hunter S. Thompson.
Huh. Are you serious?
He's a doctor of journalism.
Self-proclaimed doctor?
Wait, well, okay, so literally his doctorate is through the Universal Life Church, which if you've ever ordained a wedding.
Hey guys, as Joe was talking, I just signed up to be a doctor.
Yeah, literally, like you could do it online. Like you could be a doctor of journalism. However, only Hunter S. Thompson would insist upon being called doctor for the rest of his life.
What an intro.
This guy is going to rub me the wrong way for the next hour.
Yeah, I think that's kind of his thing.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I didn't get my doctorate from the Universal Life Church.
Should have.
I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book about a journey, I would recommend you read Joseph Conrad's masterpiece, Heart of Darkness, because he truly does carry on his wayward son. Is that a journey reference?
I'm sorry, everybody.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
As Ian was talking, I was signing up to be a doctor through the Universal Life Church, so that next week when we record, I can say, I'm Dr. Joseph Holshue.
This is the worst. This is the only like foothold I have over the two of you is being able to be a snob about my doctorate, and now everyone can get a doctorate, apparently.
Yeah. I think it might have to be a doctor of divinity. Yeah, I'm sending you the link. I'll put it in the chat.
Oh, boy.
As you know, I have a new child, so I have a lot of time on my hands right now.
It's kind of kicking
so
around.
So I was thinking I'd get a doctorate degree, and that's how you call it, right? A doctorate degree.
Nick.
Yes.
Seriously, do you love your child? Don't answer that. You need to get that child a doctorate.
Yeah. Oh, doctor.
Doctor baby. Doctor baby.
Doctor Cece.
Yep. There it is.
That's a great idea. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So I'm getting the weird impression that this theme about journeys is going to be maybe a metaphor. We should add some clarity to this week's theme. Yeah,
please do. I have stopped believing.
Is this like the band?
I have stopped believing.
Are these biographies about the band Journey? Is this like a road trip?
Yeah, for this week, I actually only read the lyrics and liner notes for all the Journey albums. That was my understanding.
That's a good one. Yep. And you're ready to go with us. Okay. I will say that I did do some research for this episode, and I did discover that there is a video game. There is a video game based on the 9x platinum album Escape by Journey. A video game based on this album released in 1982 for the Atari gaming system. So I guess that's what I have to bring. That's the value I'm bringing to this episode, is that piece of information. Oh, and this. Hey, litheads, let's talk. Guys, let's listen.
I hate it when Ian does this.
Yeah, well, just co-ops.
I'm going to slip as many allusions to Journey songs into this episode as I can.
Yeah, they got
now
that.
Nick, being the killjoy that he is, will no doubt try to edit them out, but
they know we're gonna make those bad jokes.
Some of those are gonna get in here, and I've got these, they're really subtle, they're just gonna slide in. I want you listeners to count them up and comment on our social media posts with the numbers of Journey song allusions that you can find.
Hey, did you guys know it's Don't Stop Believin'? Like an apostrophe. Yeah. Oh, God.
This is the thing that ruins Nick's day. Nothing, none of the rest of it, just this, the apostrophe.
Poor grammar. This is a literature podcast. I think we're allowed to rip on poor grammar. We should go over our show rules quickly. For our new listeners out there. All right, here are the rules. I found them in my notes.
Good.
Are you ready?
Yep.
All right. Only unavoidable spoilers, Ian.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Omit needless words, Joe.
Only.
And winning is everything.
I just wish you would. Every time you say that, I think of the Curly Lambeau quote. Or maybe it's Vince Lombardi. Winning isn't everything. Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Why don't you say that?
Do you want me to say it like him?
Yeah. Well,
winning.
You please do.
Now
do
give me the quote. Give me the quote one more time.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing.
And I think it's Vince Lombardi. I think
you're
Lombardi.
Right. I think it is.
Yeah, it is. We're from Wisconsin. It is. It's absolutely.
This is what happens. I moved away from Wisconsin 6 years ago, and already the sort of like the concrete culture is fraying at the edges. So I'm confusing Curly Lambeau and Vince Lombardi.
Yeah, they tattooed that on our new child. As soon as it came out, they were like, sorry, these are the rules in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Take us on a 30-second journey about your book.
All right.
Your time already started.
Oh, no. Fear and Loathing. How long ago? Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is it's an iconic rendition of The Pursuit of the American Dream at the end of the 1960s. What started as a 250-word assignment to write captions for Sports Illustrated turned into a 2,500-word manuscript that was, quote, aggressively rejected by the editors.
How much time do you have left?
It's filled with drugs, booze, women, fast cars, guns, motorcycle racing, heist. Oh, that's pretty. I feel happy with what I got out.
Oh, my goodness.
I like this. I'm just not going to. I figured it out. I won the game. I'm just not going to tell you when we start.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
It was really hard to pay attention to what you were saying, Joe. I'm going to be very honest. I was really excited about my timing mechanism.
as long as you heard the drugs, booze, women, fast cars, guns, and motorcycle racing, I think we're okay.
Okay.
Oh, and racing motorcycles.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Police chases, too.
Does he race against Evel Knievel ever?
He does. I think you're thinking of a dream that you had. Because, no, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen.
Is that cool, a Journey song?
I'm sure it is. Racing motorcycles against Evel Knievel, right up their alley.
Hunter S. Thompson.
Knieva. Probably about the last letter.
Knieven.
Don't stop Knieven.
Don't stop Knieven.
Yes. Love it.
Nick, I think that's the funniest thing I've ever said on this show. I would like you to keep it in, please.
That's absolutely the high point.
It's truly stupid. Oh, this is good. This is good. Just three adults spending our time wisely. All right. Fuck. All right. Ian, you know your time has already started.
Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness, is as mysterious as the jungle it depicts. A simple story with complicated characters, it condemns imperialism but profits from imperialist culture. It's a story of a young man's search for a role model and what happens when that role model is revealed to be a monster. He gets caught between confusion and pain.
I'm sorry, you have 10 seconds. Just sing Don't Stop Believing. Knieven.
I just got to Knieven. I hate this. I hate getting cut off.
I have been looking for a one-star review for Don't Stop Believing for the past 10 minutes.
That's what you thought sounded.
They don't exist. Okay. Everybody loves this song.
Oh, I read a really good one. I actually read a really good review.
Please send us your one-star reviews of Don't Stop Believing.
The album came out that had Don't Stop Believing on it, which I don't know which one it is. I think it's maybe Escape. Some music critic said, they're from San Francisco, Journey is, the music scene in San Francisco seems to be a dead end, these guys included.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So like, this is after an incredibly popular, incredibly like well-loved album.
I found a one-star review. It's really long.
Oh no.
Here's a snippet.
Snip that snippet.
There are a few songs worse than this one.
Oh, okay.
But none of them are played with the insistent regularity of it.
That's good. Insistent regularity is really good.
That is good.
Didn't Don't Stop Believing show up in a Sopranos episode?
Yeah, that's how it ends.
Oh my goodness.
No, that's how it ends?
That's a rare misstep, I think.
It's one of the best moments in TV.
Wow. Controversial opinions.
Probably. Ian, yours sounds like a downer, so let's start with yours.
Yeah, so my book is, in effect, two white dudes talking about their feelings, much like this podcast.
Yeah, you beat us. Yep. You beat all of us to that joke.
Yup. Johnny Depp is not connected to this book, not friends with the author.
Are you sure?
The author died long before Johnny Depp was sired, so that's a bummer. Can I tell you guys some little things about this book before we get into it, before I tell you about the book as itself?
Wait, what's your book's name? Heart of Darkness?
Heart of Darkness, yes.
Oh, this is old.
Yes, 1899.
Wow.
That's why you were saying Johnny Depp wasn't around.
Yes, exactly.
Now I get it.
He was not yet born.
This guy wrote Apocalypse Now?
No, I was going to get to that, Nick. Come on. Listen, I give you a lot of leash, Nick. I let you do a lot of stuff on this podcast, but you can't go Googling and getting my juiciest factoids before I get to them.
This Spoilers.
You're spoiling my life is what's happening.
I get that a lot.
I do like the idea that Ian and I like spend the entire week like pounding through these books, writing notes on them, researching the authors, and Nick just sits here and Googles shit while we're talking about them.
My mental images of Nick twirling a mustache with a pin, popping the balloons of our preparation.
Guys, I represent our listeners, okay? And they want to know the tasty movie bits.
Well, I do.
Get to the movies. That's the best part about any of your books, the movies.
I do have some movie connections if you'd like, but we'll get to them in a second. First, I'm going to tell you about this book.
I am so sorry. Please.
You're not forgiven. This is technically a novella, or as who should say, a novella. It is about 100 pages long. It's pretty short. And it was actually published in 1899 in Blackwood's Magazine. So a serial magazine which published literature, and this came out in that. It's based on the author's experiences in Africa in the 1890s, things he saw there. As Nick has so inopportunely said, the film Apocalypse Now, starring Marlon Brando and Harrison Ford, was based on this story. So a little fact about Apocalypse Now, which I can't say I love this fact, but it's really interesting and freaky. There is a scene in this film where a water buffalo is sacrificed. Ooh. And for this scene, the director actually ended up filming a ritual by members of the Ifugao tribe. They were filming on location in the Philippines. They filmed this ritual sacrificial killing of a live water buffalo, and that goes into the movie.
Wow.
So when you watch that movie, that is an actual, it's not like, you know, movie magic. It's actually a thing. So naturally, the American
was
Humane
that
Society.
Dracula?
Yes, that was Dracula weighing in on movie magic. He'll be coming back throughout the rest of the episode. When you least expect it. So naturally, the American Humane Association condemned this movie. It is a movie
Why?
That never ends. It just goes on and on and on and on.
I was just going to say, I don't want to like turn this all into Apocalypse Now talk, but I'm not super familiar with it, but I don't actors on this movie talk about the filming of Apocalypse Now as like the most harrowing time
absolutely.
Of their life. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the actors had a heart attack mid-shooting and either covered it up or had it covered up so
and they sacrificed him
and he actually dies.
Get in the water buffalo costume.
Famously like way over budget and way like just a miserable experience. It's a great film. It is super long, but it's kind of got this reputation. Orson Welles was working on an adaptation of this book, Heart of Darkness, into a movie. It never happened, as with many projects Orson Welles took on. And my favorite bit of trivia about this book, you guys have seen the film Alien, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you know what the ship is named in Alien?
It is called the Conrad, the Darkness, no. The Heart of Darkness.
It's called the Dark. No, it's called the Nostromo. Ridley Scott named this ship, the Nostromo, after one of the ships that Joseph Conrad sailed on when he was doing his preparation for writing this book. So, Conrad was sailing on a boat on the ocean. Ridley Scott has the ship in, obviously it's a spaceship, but this sort of vibe of the journey into an unknown area, which is dangerous and kind of disillusioning is very much in play. So the Nostromo.
That's like a pop culture explosion right now. Wait, so Apocalypse Now is based on Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, closely based, I would say. I mean, Heart of Darkness is not set during the Vietnam conflict.
So different. Yeah, okay.
Time travel.
I was going to say, that'd be pretty incredible. Does this predict many wars or?
Listen, Vietnam, guys, it's going to be terrible.
Mark my words.
So yeah, it's a pretty good book. It's worth reading. I can tell you about like what happens in the book briefly if you'd like, or I can just jump into why you should read it. What do you want? I can do this any way you want it.
Fuck. I don't even know if that was the first reference.
Oh no. Oh, there have been like four already.
No.
Okay, so,
yes.
Litheads, don't forget to comment.
Ugh.
Okay, so I'll just tell you like what happens in the book, and I'll talk about why it's worth reading because it is a book where things do happen. This, maybe one-star reviews might say nothing happens in this book. I get a lot of those, but there is this dude. There's this main, our main character is named Charles Marlowe, and Marlowe wants to work in Africa. He sees Africa as mysterious and dark and foreboding and full of promise. So he makes his way to an area which is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He works in this company. The company's not named, but it's pretty clear who it is. I'll talk more about that later. And he's moving along the river, and he's checking in with this ivory company that he works for. So the company.
Wait, why is he there?
He's working for this company.
He's employed by this company, and he wants to go. He really wants to go to Africa.
And this company's like harvesting something, like sugarcane or something, or
harvesting rubber and ivory. Yes.
Okay.
Ivory specifically.
Did I just forget?
I did.
Shit.
Elephant tusks. Ivory. So Marlowe is like taking this journey. And
Damn it.
He's moving up the river into the depth of Africa. And he's kind of like checking in along the way with these outposts along the river. And he encounters setback after setback. I don't need to go into those. As he continues, he has to wait around a lot. He becomes more and more disillusioned. So this is a journey of disillusionment. He's seeing cruelty. He's seeing brutality. He's seeing inefficiency. He's kind of getting bummed out. But he's also developing this obsession with a station manager named Kurtz. That's spelled K-U-R-T-Z.
When you say station manager, like an outpost manager?
Yeah, so a certain outpost where Africans bring ivory to him, and then he ships it down the river.
He has
a lot of authority. These station managers have a lot of authority. They can be pretty cruel, but they're also kind of responsible for how well the station does, how well the company does.
Sure.
If the station is doing well, they're getting in a lot of ivory and sending it down the river. And so Kurtz is like this superstar. Everyone thinks he's the best at this, this kind of collecting.
When he's in Africa, are there any wheels in the sky at all?
No, that's such a ham.
Yeah, that wasn't very subtle. Not very subtle. Maybe you don't want to talk about this right now.
Did the people welcome him with open arms?
Okay, Nick, I need you to stop because you're going to blow up all of my good
spots. Or did they
just
go their separate ways?
Okay. What are you going
to
ask, Joe?
Was he faithful to his job?
What company needs rubber and ivory? That's what I don't know.
Well, this is a thing.
You ever see those pianos with wheels?
No. Stop it.
Ian, if you ought to put Nick on mute, I can do the same
Great
thing.
Call.
And then you and I can just talk about this book.
So this is the Congo Free State is not actually free. It's a colony privately owned by the King of Belgium. The King of Belgium was named Leopold II. He wanted money, don't we all? And he referred to this private colony as, quote, a slice of this magnificent African cake. So the European powers were carving up Africa. Leopold wanted some. So he arranged through a series of machinations to get a colony which fed directly into his pocket. Okay, back to Kurtz. And I'm going to drop in a hobbit fact here. Kurtz in German means short. And hobbits are actually pretty short. Now, earlier in the life of Middle Earth, when Middle Earth was a younger land, hobbits were taller. But over time, hobbits have grown shorter and shorter, and some are as short as 2 feet tall. So there's your hobbit fact for the day.
Wow. It's kind of like how fish in caves lose their eyes, right? After generation to generation.
Right.
They didn't need to be tall. Yeah.
Maybe it's like fish where like if you put them in a small bowl, like they stay that size of the bowl, you know?
Yeah.
So like
exactly.
they have really small homes. So that's
yeah,
why
they have to fit in the hobbit holes.
It's the hobbit housing crisis. It's a real issue.
Oh. My goodness.
Change the laws. Okay, back to Kurtz. I'm done with my Hobbit fact. Back to Kurtz. So Kurtz has this magnetic personality.
Back to white people exploiting the people, the continent of Africa.
Kurtz is like clearly going to be bad. Like you, this is the foreshadowing I was talking about, like the epic ending. Kurtz ends up being a bad guy. And the book kind of like signals this all the way through. So it's not a spoiler. It's like you start reading it. It's pretty clear, pretty fast that he is not going to be living up to this high reputation, this superstar reputation. So a lot of people think he's amazing. Everyone's talking about him. People respect him and admire him, but they're also annoyed by how like he kind of sucks all the oxygen out of a room. So Marlowe, our main character, develops this obsession with Kurtz. And he's going up the river towards Kurtz's station. After weeks of struggling and delay, he finally gets to meet him. And Kurtz turns out to be insane and cruel and abusing his power over the natives at the station. And in the eyes of the Ivory Company, this is the worst thing. He's doing a bad job. So he's super sick, and they take him down the river. And all of the people that he was, the Africans that Kurtz was abusing, don't like this, and they try and get him back. And I'm not going to kind of spoil where this goes, but it ends pretty badly for everyone involved. And Marlowe goes back to Europe. Yeah. Marlowe goes back to Europe, and there's this like
totally alone
grim. Yeah, he is alone. This grim moment where he is like realizing what the heart of darkness truly is. And Kurtz and all of his friends have truly gone their separate ways, and they are alone individuals, disillusioned, separate. It's a real bummer. Ending.
It does sound like a drag. This book sounds like a drag, Dr. Dion.
Well, it's weird. Okay, so that phrase sounds like a drag. I would say it's a bummer. I would not say it's a drag, because to me, like, it sounds like a drag is like not readable. This is eminently readable. It will not leave you in a place where you feel good about like the world. But that's not what it's trying to do. It's not trying to like make you feel.
But what does?
Well, and I think this is something. This is a nice segue to the idea of the journey. A lot of good journey books kind of pair this physical movement with personal discovery.
Careful, Joe.
So like he moves from. This is one of the reasons why I think this book is worth reading. This book really matches Marlowe kind of taking this physical journey, moving up the river, learning about the world around him, losing his rosy idea that colonization is a good thing, and realizing that things are actually terrible. He realizes this as we see it unfold before him. And then
like
he gets
out. What's terrible? Like the exploitation going on?
Oh, boy. Here we go. Okay. So this is another reason why I think this book is really worth reading. It is a window.
Give me that meat. Give me that water buffalo meat.
There is brutality along those lines.
Okay.
This book is worth reading because it is a window on the colonial colonizer's mindset. So I told you about the Congo Free State. Leopold really, really wanted this to be his. And so he did whatever it took to get his fortune in elephant ivory and rubber. He allowed murder. He allowed cruelty. He allowed barbarism. He made this law that if there was land that did not have a house on it, it was by default the property of the state and could be used to enrich the state. So unless you build a house on land, you cannot own that land. And when I say you, I mean the Africans there who had lived there since time immemorial. And these companies, especially the rubber companies, enslaved Congolese people, adults and children, and made them produce rubber. And if they didn't meet their quotas, they would have the hands cut off of the people who were not producing the rubber. It was like slavery, but instead of like shipping the slaves across the sea, it was like going to where the Africans were and enslaving them there.
Before I think we just need a little clarification here.
Yes.
Is any of this based on any people, like any real life events, or what is happening?
No.
Well, it has to be the disgust in your voice and just the reality of how disgusting humans are. Like this has to be based on something, right?
Yeah. So like the baseline of like the culture, the ways that the Africans were treated, all of this stuff did happen. And what he does is there are these really powerful passages where he talks about this and he kind of clarifies like this is how it is. And we know as we read it that, yes, this is how it was. But there are also concrete characters in this book who are based on the people that Marlowe met. Marlowe kind of had a voyage of discovery where he gradually learned that, like, the world is a bleak place and human beings are generally terrible to each other. And, like, he saw these things. So the voyage that Charles Marlowe takes, the main character, is similar to the sort of voyage of discovery that Joseph Conrad took. So he is basing these off of various people. One of the big questions about Heart of Darkness is, who is Kurtz? Like, we know that Conrad does this, where he kind of writes people he met into his books. Is there a basis for Kurtz? And I think, I'm not a Conrad scholar, but the scholars have determined there are a few people that this could be based on. The problem is...
his friend, Schmertz.
Exactly. There was not just one...
The names have been changed in this
terrible
book.
Person. There were a lot of them.
Like, the horrible part is there's a few candidates, right? They're like, well, exactly, it could have been any of these seven horrible people. Right.
It's really these, too many to choose.
At the end of this book, you can ask, who's crying now? And the answer would be Marlowe.
Fuck. A lot of references.
Okay. Why do you teach this book in your class, I guess?
Well, it's weird. Like I say, it's a bummer. It's a downer book. I think it's valuable to have this window on the history and sort of the way that people think, the colonial mindset.
Does it get into history? Does it, like, I guess I'm just still pretty unclear about how much of this is, like, true. Is this, I know I joked about it, but, like, did they change the names, you know, yes, to tell the story? Is this a real series of events and just, yes, told through the eyes of a fictional character? Or
so it's like you see those movies and it says based on a true story. Like, it is sort of shaped. It's shaped into something which is entertaining and interesting. It's fictional, but a lot of the things that happen in this book happened in real life, either to Conrad or just in general. A lot of the characters in this book are based on real people, and he changed the names a very little bit. Some of the names are changed just a tiny, tiny amount. Like a J becomes a Y. That simple.
I was just kidding.
No, really, seriously. Happens? Seriously. He's very much interested in, like, not... He's not going to sugarcoat this. He's not going to make this story, this magical story of, like, a man who finds himself and learns about the glories of colonization in Africa. It's like he takes this journey. He has these high hopes. He's naive, and he gets there and he's like, oh crap, this is basically hell on earth. It's hell for the Africans. It's hell for the people who are going into it. Like, doing this act of colonization ruins human beings.
Okay. So give me the year on this again. Is it 1899?
1899.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So Ian, I've got something I think you're going to like. Are you familiar with the poem, The White Man's Burden?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm actually going to teach it next semester.
So you'll be very happy to know that it's written in the exact same year as this book.
Oh, I'm delighted by that.
1899, and it's about the American-Philippine War. Nick, have you ever heard of this, The White Man's Burden?
Negative.
So The White Man's Burden is this poem by Rudyard Kipling, which is, you've probably heard of, as the guy that wrote The Jungle Book. Right. Yep. And he was this, he was this, like, I guess he grew up in colonial India, would be my guess. I don't know a lot about him, but I think he grew up in colonial India. And long story short, I don't want to cut into Ian's time here. He wrote this poem about the responsibility of white men, or, like, the white world, to colonize the savages of the world, right? To colonize, to make it better. Like, hey, we are enlightened. We have this job to make it better. When I first read this poem, I didn't really have any context for it. I thought it was meant to be ironic. Like, I thought it was, like, it reads as so over the top and so, like, whatever the opposite of woke is what this poem is, right? Like, it is crazy to read. And the fact that these two things are written at the same time is a crazy juxtaposition, a crazy contrast.
Yeah. It's a time when people are making millions of dollars off of colonization. And some people think that's great. And also some people are seeing the human cost and condemning it as terrible. And I think one thing about this book is that it's not perfect. It is not a perfect book, and it's making a good point. Imperialism is bad. It's also written from the perspective of somebody doing imperializing. So there's this tiny corner of your mind which wonders if, like, how much would Conrad maybe agree with Rudyard Kipling? What if he's saying, not all colonization is bad, but rather this colonization
this
is bad.
One.
Like, you don't know how racist they were.
Exactly. Well,
it's a really long time ago. They were probably a little racist.
There's this Nigerian author named Chinua Achebe, who you folks have probably heard of. He wrote this amazing book called Things Fall Apart, which I want to do for the podcast at some point. Really good book. Deals with similar issues, the problems caused by colonization. And Achebe in the 1970s basically said, this book is not worth reading. It's got this overwhelming white perspective, and it doesn't consider the point of view of the African victims, which I think is a legitimate concern. Like, the book is all focused on, look at how bad this is. The Africans are victims, and the white people are also victims. But the Africans are bodies. They're not humans. They're not we don't learn the emotional toll of this on the Africans.
Really?
Yeah, they're never personified. Like, you don't get an African character when that's
anything. So it doesn't even get into that, huh?
No, it does some. There are some, but it's not.
That's not the point.
It's from a white person's. It's from a white man's perspective, and it's more interested in the white man's perspective than in the African perspective. So I think it's a really weird thing. It's doing a good. I think it does good in the world. Like, I assign this to my students so we can talk about Leopold II, and we can talk about like blending history and fiction, but we also have to realize this book does not go far enough.
I feel like there's some stuff like that, books, maybe even movies, where it's like, wait, how did you mean it? It's like they wrote it, but it's written a really long time ago. And you're like, well, I know how to interpret that now, but wait, how did you mean that exactly? When you wrote that, what did you mean by that exactly? Because I get the impression that it could have had a different meaning.
I was just reading Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice. And The Merchant of Venice has this.
Me too.
That makes
three of us.
What's your favorite part, Joe? Go first.
I like the pound of flesh part. What's your favorite part, Nick?
That's also my favorite part. All right, okay. Ian, keep going with your story.
No, I was just going to say that The Merchant of Venice is a good example of this kind of thing, where it's got this central character, Shylock, who is a Jewish moneylender, and a lot of the other characters in the play are really anti-Semitic towards him. And you're like, okay, this is a play about how dangerous and damaging anti-Semitism is. But then Shylock does some things which are kind of stereotypically anti-Semitic. So you're like, oh wait, the play is also confirming these things. So you're like, what are you saying? Are you saying anti-Semitism is bad? Or are you saying, ha ha, it's a fine thing?
Right.
It's not clear. I think Heart of Darkness is more clear than that. It's pretty obvious, the perspective he's taking, but
do you ever wonder what our I don't know how to say this,
blind spot is?
Yeah, what is our blind spot? What is the stuff absolutely. That 100 years from now students are going to be looking back at us going, wow, they were barbaric, right? Because I think of this, and when you talk about
no, we are shining light of forward thinking.
Yeah, forward thinking, progress, right? But I think of things like sweatshops is what comes to mind. Fact that we all wear this clothing, and every once in a while there's a 60 Minutes expose on this one particular Nike sweatshop. But it's I think it's probably pretty universal, right? Or the fact that your cell phone is built by essentially what we would characterize as slave labor, but we all have a $1,000 cell phone in our pocket.
Right. I like how Joe is immediately focused on the one of the many, many things that absolutely hasn't changed in the 100 years since this book was written. were people going over to other countries and exploiting them to make millions of dollars? Good thing that isn't happening anymore. So maybe more than 100 years.
One other thing I want to just really quickly say about this book. Like any good journey book, there are a variety of unexpected obstacles that come up along the way. And so we don't get so much invested in will Marlowe conquer the obstacles? It's much more will the universe keep conspiring to move him forward? Will he keep just kind of inexorably moving on his journey? And he does. And this book is only 100 pages. But by the time we get to this end, this meeting of Kurtz, it's been teased so well and so carefully built up. We have this mental image of Kurtz. So 100 pages doesn't feel like a lot of buildup. And he doesn't meet him on page 99. He beats him fairly in the middle of it. Towards them, maybe two-thirds of the way through. But even though it's not been 300 pages of buildup, it feels like a huge revelation, a massive climax. It is not the journey, it's the destination. This book is all about getting to this revelation. Kurtz is terrible. People are terrible. Darkness is everywhere. The heart of darkness is the human heart.
Yeah. Bleak.
Why should I read this book?
Powerful. It's powerful. It grips you. So like, it teaches you things. It makes you like research. It makes you kind of do that thing where like, oh, wait, is this real? Is this history? It is. It's like, that's good. That's worth doing. And I think as journey books go, like watching Marlowe's perspective change is fascinating. It's short enough to do in a sitting. And it's, I think, worth reading in a sitting. You charge through it and you end up, you are changed like Marlowe is changed. That's why you should read it.
I had no idea that was based on Apocalypse Now.
Wow. It's not.
Apocalypse Now is based on this.
Incredible timing.
I will say, if you read this book, you need to end after you're done. Take a break.
No.
Drink a nice beer. Damn and it. Be good to yourself.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Next week is our last back to school week. Do you guys, I thought we'd send it off on a high note. Do you guys know any books with like super happy endings?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's all literature is happy endings.
Joe, let's say it in unison.
Okay. Ready? One.
Yeah.
Two. Well, you already started.
I feel like I know what you're saying in unison.
We're saying the name
of
the book.
The words happy endings?
The book. Oh,
okay. The first book that comes to mind when you think happy ending.
Right.
Gotcha.
The ultimate tale of happy endings, which is, of course, William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Julian.
Perfect in perfect unison. Much like Romeo and Juliet's relationship, we are perfectly sync with one another.
Smooth sailing is from what I know about it.
Yep. Well, I got good news for you. It is. It's perfectly happy. It's great.
Everything turns out
that's
fine.
That's my pitch. That's my pitch for this book. Sweet. It's perfectly happy. It's great.
I can't wait to hear about that next week. Thank you, guys.
From the Shakespearean scholar's mouth to your ears, folks. It's perfectly happy. It's great.
Joseph Holshue.
I'm ready.
Joseph Conrad.
Dr.
Joseph Conrad.
Doctor elect.
Guys, I'm not a doctor yet. I still have to hit the checkout button on the Universal Life Church website.
Shopping cart elect.
Did you forget your cart?
Did you forget your doctorate degree? Let me know if they have any BOGOs.
So I read for this week Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is subtitled A Savage Journey into the Heart of the American Dream, which is Dr. Hunter S. Thompson's most famous book. It's kind of a crazy book to read, because when we hear Ian talk about like this idea of like this engrossing book that talks about the world being a bleak place and how humans are terrible to one another, like, he could have been describing this book. Like, he could be describing.
Oh, no. Hey, Nick, you've got two bummers here for you.
Yeah, let's change this week to downers.
Well, the difference, though, is and Ian talks about Heart of Darkness being an engrossing read, like this one that's like kind of unputdownable. The energy in Fear and Loathing is absolutely manic. Like, it is. and when I say manic, like, I mean, part of it is the fact that almost the entire time when Hunter S. Thompson was writing this book, he was, I guess, a little bit of backstory to it. He was hired by Sports Illustrated to go to Las Vegas and witness this motorcycle race through the desert. And his only job was to write captions for the photographer. So it wasn't a big article or anything like that. He was just writing captions for this.
No shit.
And they said,
this is in the good old days when you could be paid to go to Las Vegas to watch a motorcycle race and write captions for photographs.
Yeah, journalism really has changed. He goes to Las Vegas, and Sports Illustrated pays him $300 for this. And he gets his lawyer, this guy who he just keeps referring to as his Samoan lawyer. He picks him up in this rented bright red Buick convertible. And they, the night before, go out and collect as many drugs as they can collect, right? And it's uppers, downers, it's booze, it's alcohol, it's ether. It's like stuff I didn't even know you could do as a drug, right? But they blow.
List the drugs.
Butter, sugar, flour, eggs.
If you take enough of anything, you can get high.
Vanilla extract. He's not going
to
list drugs.
No,
for you,
I am going to. I am going to. Shit, I have to find them.
They're illegal. That was a test.
The very first line here is, we were somewhere around Bastro on the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take hold. Which
classic line.
I would put as one of the better opening lines of a novel ever.
That's a good line.
It's a good line.
Pretty good.
And he talks about this drug collection, and he says they had bought LSD, ether, cocaine, alcohol, mescaline, and cannabis. He also talks about amyls. I don't know what amyls are. Amyl nitrates. There's a lot of stuff I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I could see that happening.
Yeah. Is this
one of those books that like you have to be a cool kid to appreciate? Because like I don't really know.
Do you have
about
to have done
drugs?
Yeah. Do you have to have done a lot of methamphetamine to do this, to enjoy this book?
I think this book really has this celebrated place among like drug culture people, right? Like I had this roommate in college who had the tattoo of the freak party on his arm, which is like this party that Hunter S. Thompson ran for sheriff in the 1970s. And he, like they held this book up as like a totem almost, right? Like this was a book that,
yeah,
I think they celebrate it for almost a romantic depiction of drug culture. But I would also say that that is a pretty severe misreading of this book. Like, I don't think Hunter S. Thompson would say that. Yeah.
Welcome to Hot Takes.
So he and his attorney.
No, that's not that. Please, no.
I'm going to sum up the plot really quickly here because there's not much. He and his attorney go to Las Vegas to cover this motorcycle race. Doing drugs the entire way, right? Like in the convertible drive from LA to Vegas, they're taking these drugs, they're drinking, they're doing this ether, right? When they get to Las Vegas, they're like trying to appear sober as they check into their hotel, as they go to the first day of the race, etc.
Yeah.
They quickly find that the race is almost uncoverable. It's this motorcycle race through the desert. The motorcycles leave the starting line and they don't return for an hour, right? And they can like get in these chase vehicles, but you can't see what's happening through this cloud of dust that's happening. So they basically just bail on it and devote 3 days to just a bender, right? And the whole first half of this book is this 3-day bender with him and his attorney as they tear up Las Vegas, essentially.
So as I look at these 1-star reviews, are these just squares? Are these just squares? You don't understand how cool it is to take drugs in the desert?
Hit me with a 1-star review, Nick.
Smug, dated, boring. Ugh. Here you go. Here's no literary merit. Ugh. That's pretty squarish. It sounds like a square if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, you know who would disagree is Cormac McCarthy, who calls it a classic of our time and one of the few great American novels.
So suck that, Jessica. Yeah.
I believe Cormac.
Gotta bring Jessica and Cormac McCarthy on the show and have them just do a throwdown.
Does this book read like a Keith Richards like autobiography?
Okay.
Or what, you know? Is this just a series of events? You know what
Can
I mean?
Can you understand it?
Well, so every once in a while, I'll get interested in something. And like nerds, this is what nerds do. I learn about things by not doing them, but by reading about them. So a few years ago, I got really interested in like hip hop culture. And I started reading all about hip hop. Similarly, there's like these forums online dedicated to drug use, right? And drug use is something that I have no experience with. If you are from the administration of my high school, I want to repeat that. I have no experience with.
Can I tangent off of your tangent?
Yeah.
I was reading there's some subreddit thread going on, and somebody asked Reddit, and they're like, hey, how good is heroin?
And, it's a blast.
and sure as shit, you know, all these, you know, former heroin addicts are commenting. And the top one was a guy who's like, hey, I just want to preference my comment by saying drugs are really bad and like heroin is the worst. And please do not try it. Having said that, it is amazing. I think the question was like, is heroin better than sex? And he's like, yeah, absolutely it is.
Wow.
He's like, imagine having an orgasm for like 8 hours. But don't do drugs.
Wow. So one of the things people will do is they'll take, especially like mind expanding drugs, like they'll eat mushrooms or they'll take LSD and they'll write what they call a trip report.
That one, there was a documentary called Limitless about you take a pill and
famous documentary.
Expands your mental capacity.
Yep, with Johnny Depp. Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
So they write trip reports, right? Which is basically them saying, hey, I took mushrooms, like I ate mushrooms in the middle of the desert. Let me tell you what I figured out. Or let me tell you what my experiences were like. And they write these for other people to read. And when you read these, they are very frequently like somebody describing a fever dream to you. And we've all had the experience of somebody like trying to tell us a dream and it just doesn't matter to us. It's nonsense to us, right? I think one of the fantastic things about Fear and Loathing is both Hunter S. Thompson, and he's kind of lightly fictionalized in this novel as a character named Raoul Duke, but it is absolutely a stand-in for Hunter S. Thompson and his attorney, are under the influence of something or everything, this entire novel. And the narration is really frantic and at times paranoid and always manic, but it is always very like acute and understandable. Like when he gives us his experiences, he talks through his thought process. Like he never tells you what it feels like. Instead, he talks about what the outside world seems like. And he, even though he's drugged up the entire time, his first person narration really reads as kind of straight or kind of sober. It's almost like he's a detached observer. And it's this really cool effect when you read it. And it really kind of makes you feel like it kind of makes you feel like you just, you know, snorted a bunch of ether, or it kind of makes you feel like you just took a bunch of LSD, right? Like you get it through his eyes, but it's not the nonsensical ramblings of a drug lunatic.
Do you keep feeling that way throughout the whole of the book, or does it sort of, you talked about the first half of this bender. Does it kind of like, do they come down?
I think the middle and the end are also benders.
So the second half is also a bender.
Okay. The first half is a bender. The second half is recovering in the hotel room.
Yeah. So the first half of this novel is them going to cover this motorcycle race and basically doing the worst job ever covering this motorcycle race as they go on a bender. Just as they're about to, I mean, really flee Las Vegas because they've made a number of enemies. They've run up this massive hotel bill. Just as they're about to flee Las Vegas, Rolling Stone calls them and they said, hey, we'd like you to stay in Vegas for a few days because there is a gathering of the Anti-Narcotics Administration at this hotel down the road and we would like you to cover it. So these two guys go to this new hotel and basically bomb around and hang out with a bunch of like cops, like anti-narcotics cops, because they feel, and a great line that Thompson has, he said, they're there to talk about drugs, and we thought that drugs should have a voice in the conversation.
Oh boy.
There's more to this book though, correct?
Yeah. So,
or is this just a great book at understanding drugs if you never want to take them yourself?
It's like reading this book gives you the experience of taking drugs.
Like listening to this podcast is a good way to hear about the book so you don't have to read it.
Like it starts out and the drugs seem kind of fun, right? Like the drug culture seems like fun and exciting.
Sure.
And the word I keep saying is manic, but that's absolutely the pace of this book. But as it goes on, that high, like that upper, turns into this paranoia, right? Like, and the pace stops being so like manic and starts being a little bit frantic. I do think that Thompson is saying, like, look, people look for solace in drugs. Like people look for, like, it's not even solace. They look for experience in drugs. Like they think there's something at the end of that tunnel, right? And he's saying, look, there's not. Right. Like there is absolutely nothing at the end of that tunnel. And this book is written in 1971. It is very much a backlash of the 1960s.
Is this a bit of a surprise that he seems to be sort of giving this sobering message? Or is it, is that not who he is? Is he just like a teller of truth no matter what?
Okay, yeah, I love that question because I think you're dead on. Like, this is not moralistic.
Good questioning,
right?
Good
like,
questions.
It is not. Points. It is absolutely not. Hunter S. Thompson saying, "Don't do drugs, kids." Right. And he lived through the 60s, which is this time, as we all know, of like social progress, which is this time of change and a time of this tremendous momentum, right? Like this tremendous momentum kind of towards good is what Thompson would say. But he thinks the 60s went awry when the hippies kind of embraced drug culture as strongly as they did, right? And he kind of talks about Las Vegas as this kind of end result of the American dream, right? Like you're saying, hey, if you follow the American dream, this rags to riches story, this capitalist like promise to its end,
to its logical conclusion,
Interesting. You end up in Las Vegas.
It is. I think this idea that it's capitalism taken to its logical conclusion is right on. Like it is, it is the place where anything can be acquired.
Like that's like that stuff. Like ultimately there's no substance there, right? Thompson talks about drugs, or he shows drugs kind of in the same light, right? Where he says, look, you take LSD and it expands your mind. Also like shows like when you are taking those drugs, when you're on this bender, when you've acquired this drug collection, like he and his lawyer have as an end in itself, it's empty and it's manic and it is frantic and paranoid, right? And it is absolutely not a good place to be.
Joe, would you say this book is a Romana Clef or no?
I think the first paragraph of the Wikipedia article says it is Romana Clef.
Ooh, hey, you know what, Nick? You keep relying on those and Joe and I will get wise and start editing Wikipedia to say things to make you... Would you say, like, do you think Thompson, the book would agree with the comment that Nick found on social media about, like, it's don't do it. It'll change you. It's an incredible feeling. Don't do it.
I don't think he, to the end of his life, ever rejected any of this. Like, he was a famous kind of, like, he was a famous eccentric to the end of his life. And that included heavy alcoholism, and that included drug use, and it included, like, drugs. When he died, famously, you might know this, but for all the loyal Lidhuds out there, when he died by suicide. I'm forgetting the word where they burn your body. Cremated. There you go. He was cremated and put into a cannon. Like his will, he was put into a cannon, his ashes, and shot up into the air at this massive party while Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man played. Whoa. Right? And Johnny Depp paid for his funeral. It cost about $3 million.
Oh my goodness.
He actually has a great quote where he says, "I hate to advocate drugs, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me."
Can you wrap up your time by just sharing Hunter S. Thompson stories? Because I feel like
whenever I'm trying
to understand this book, I just need to read stories about him.
Okay. I'm just going to like rapid fire. When running for sheriff under the Freak Party, he shaved his head and he constantly referred to the crew cut Republican candidate that he was running against as, quote, my long haired opponent.
Oh, yes.
Is that how you refer to most people?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to start. My long haired friend here. In his suicide note, he says, no more games, no more bombs, no more walking, no more fun, no more swimming. 67. That's 17 years past 50 and 17 more than I wanted. Boring. I'm always busy. No fun for anybody. 67. You're getting greedy. Act your age. Relax. This won't hurt, which is very scary.
Jesus, his last words were, this won't hurt?
This won't hurt. Last one I have is he was friends with Jack Nicholson.
That tracks.
Yep. 1 year, he wanted to wish Jack Nicholson a happy birthday.
Oh, no.
He did so pulling up outside Nicholson's house in the middle of the night, firing a 40 million candle power parachute flare into the air to light up like basically like 3 square miles. Out of his car, he played a tape which contained recorded shrieks of dying pigs through this massive loudspeaker.
Yep.
And then he fired several rounds from an automatic handgun into the air. He wanted Nicholson to come outside so that he could wish him happy birthday, but Nicholson had actually received some notes from a stalker lately that were threatening, so he refused. So Thompson left him as a birthday gift a recently cut out elk heart on his step, and Nicholson found it when blood started seeping under his door.
Why should I read it, though?
A damning pause.
Okay. Well, no. Well, congratulations, Ian.
One of the reasons I like to show this to students is so that they can see, you know, they've been exposed to the canon. They've been exposed to like the classic
funeral
literature so far. One of the reasons I like to teach this is to show them this is what a book can be like. Like, isn't this book a blast to read? Doesn't this tell you about a world that you had no idea about? That's what this book can be. That's what a book can be.
It just goes to show what you get when you stop reading the classic books by old white men and you read a book by a different white man who did a lot of drugs.
By a different old white man.
Huh. Well, I don't know why race is a thing here, but I will agree that it is certainly different. But I really like Apocalypse Now, so I kind of didn't know that that was based on a book, so I'm really excited. I would like to read that.
Oh, son of a bitch.
Because I think it's one of the... and I have no idea what the book is like, but in the movie, the unveiling of the villain...
Yeah.
It is so earned.
Yes.
Yeah. And yep. I'm just so curious to know how the book handles that, obviously with a completely different subject matter. But I also think the fact that that's the subject matter that this is based on, that movie adaptation is incredible. Like, yeah, it's incredible.
It's one of the ones where, like, you don't feel like one is a knockoff of the other. One is greater than the other. They're both brilliant in their own regards. And,
okay.
They feed on each other. So reading the book, seeing the movie, once you've done both, both experiences are richer, I think.
Sorry, Joe. I've never seen the movie Fear and Loathing, so maybe if I would have watched that,
wasn't Johnny Depp in Fear and Loathing?
Yeah,
movie?
and that's how they met. That's how Johnny Depp and Hunter S. Thompson met, and they were friends till the end of Thompson's life.
He was also in Apocalypse Now.
There you go. Congratulations to Apocalypse Now for winning this podcast.
Seems that way. Marlon Brando.
Ian, break us off a taste.
Okay. So this is the end, near the end of Heart of Darkness, and it's a very famous section. But I feel like you have to read this section. So Kurtz has he's sick. They've taken him away from the station where he was just totally brutalizing and mismanaging everything, and they take him on this ship back down the river. And Kurtz is getting worse and worse. In this quote, "I" is Charles Marlowe, our narrator, our main character. One evening, coming in with a candle, I was startled to hear him say a little tremulously, "I am lying here in the dark waiting for death." The light was within a foot of his eyes. I forced myself to murmur, "Oh, nonsense," and stood over him as if transfixed. Anything approaching the change that came over his features I have never seen before and hope never to see again. Oh, I wasn't touched. I was fascinated. It was as though a veil had been rent. I saw on that ivory face the expression of somber pride, of ruthless power, of craven terror, of an intense and hopeless despair. Did he live his life again in every detail of desire, temptation, and surrender during that supreme moment of complete knowledge? He cried in a whisper at some image, at some vision. He cried out twice, a cry that was no more than a breath. The horror! The horror! I blew the candle out and left the cabin. Thank you.